This is an ABC podcast.
G'day and welcome to Country Breakfast. My name's Clint Jasper. Since 2016, a bitter trans-Tasman war has raged between Australian and New Zealand honey producers over the word Manuka. This week, with another Australian win, there are hopes the two sides can finally put down their legal weapons.
Mate, we would like to think that we could, but it will be difficult because of their dirty tricks.
But first, Kath Macklin is here to bring us the rural news of the week. Good morning, Kath.
Good morning, Clint.
The ever-titillating Senate estimates were on again this week, and on Tuesday, the Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry was fielding questions. Earlier this year, the department was broke, literally running out of money, but that seems to have been fixed up now.
It was one of the first questions to come up at Tuesday's hearing, and long story short, officials were pleased to report the department's budget black hole had been repaired. Interestingly, it came to light that the previous coalition government had known for some time that there wasn't enough money flowing into the department's coffers, and that had that actually been limiting its hiring of staff and their travel. It was made worse when the DAWE, or DAWE, these acronyms of government departments are always confusing, when DAWE became DAF, because the water portfolio's move into the environment department took a big chunk of the money away from the agricultural department. And last year's quick ramp up of efforts to keep foot and mouth disease at bay was the cherry on top that really sent it into the red, so that a lot of money went into that. But the department's secretary, Paul Metcalfe, says with the recent budget's injection of funds into biosecurity and other things and some new levies, the department is now back in the black.
Where we've got to now with this budget is confidence that cost recovery, which is a significant part of both biosecurity and exports, is on a pathway to becoming full cost recovery. It's always a lagging feature, though. It's sort of, you're always sort of behind what's happening, so that's a factor for us. But the other aspect is that, as the Minister has indicated, we now have long-term predictable funding for biosecurity that's baked into the budget and continues indefinitely.
Let's head to Western Australia now, where it's estimated up to 1 million sheep are in paddocks right now, which need to be sold but don't actually have a market.
Yeah, it's interesting. The last live export ship for the season has sailed from Fremantle, with the summer moratorium to the Middle East about to start, and local abattoirs in WA are booked out solid for the next 2 months. So the federal government has committed to ending the live trade permanently in its next term of government, and it's raising questions about what the industry will look like when it's gone. So WA farmers will be by far and away the hardest hit by the phasing out of live sheep exports by sea. The trade's estimated to be worth more than $90 million, and most of those sheep come from WA. So what we have at the moment is there's a moratorium over the Northern Hemisphere summer, and that came about after that footage of animals, you know, dying of heat stress and subsequent investigations into those issues. So it only kind of happens for half the year, but we will see. At some stage, it stopped altogether. Paul Brown is from Jenna Livestock Services, and he says what they're seeing at the moment is really painting a grim picture for the sheep sector in Western Australia.
It has undermined the confidence on every sheep farmer. Now they're looking, okay, well, if this is what's happening this year, is it going to happen next year? Well, do I start culling sheep? Do I start reducing my flock? And that has flow-on effects to throughout the whole agricultural industry, shearing, trucking, local communities, the wool industry.
I think that's what the independent panel is looking at now in terms of how you phase that industry out. They're saying if you take this trade away, you need to replace it with domestic processing, because even with the trade in place, the abattoirs are still full up. And we saw that story not long ago with the abattoir near Katanning buying the local motel just so it had enough places for its staff to stay. So they need a lot more processing over there. But let's stay on live export, because mechanical failures on a vessel bound for Indonesia last week saw cattle stuck on board in Darwin for 6 whole days.
Yeah, there was a major engine failure on board the livestock carrier Nine Eagle. And that meant around 1,800 head of cattle had to be unloaded on Monday due to animal welfare concerns. So the stock were returned to the quarantine yards after the unloading order by the Federal Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry. Tom Dawkins is from the NT Livestock Exporters Association, and he says all the cattle were accounted for and they were in good health when they got off the ship, because they'd been receiving daily vet checks since the export vessel had been moored.
There's been certainly extra attention given to them in recent days, including with daily inspections by Commonwealth Vet, and all reports so that they're in good order and there's no reason to expect they won't get back now to the export yard.
Let's look at a different type of cattle now. Australia's milk production is continuing to languish and local milk processors say they're struggling to stay competitive.
Milk production is forecast to drop another half a billion litres for the current, the 2022-23 season. And that will put it just below 8 billion litres. By 2030, it's tipped that Australian farmers will only be producing about 6 billion litres. So just for some context, that is almost half of what the milk dairy farmers in Australia were producing back in the peak of production, which was about 20 years ago, back in 2002. Executive Chair of the Processor Lobby Group, Australian Dairy Products Federation, John Williams, says that lower farm gate prices in New Zealand is also putting Australia at a disadvantage as imports grow. He says if volumes of milk continue to drop, then dairy processors may be forced to close even more factories.
The obvious impact is that we have less milk to meet the growing demand for Australian dairy products, but most importantly, we start to lose efficiencies in our plants when we don't have milk flowing through them, which increases the cost base of production.
And you mentioned their imports. We're already seeing the impact of that declining milk production in Australia.
Yeah, with that falling milk production, as we just mentioned, and the higher farm gate prices, dairy imports are skyrocketing, which is kind of weird because you think of Australia not that long ago as being such a dairy powerhouse that really was exporting to the world. But over the past 12 months, imports rose 15%. The products are coming from the USA, New Zealand and the EU. It's not so much like your fresh milk, your litres of milk that is coming into Australia from those countries. It's more things like processed cheese and then raw products like lactose and whey. They are the main products that are coming in at the moment. That's according to Dairy Australia's industry analyst, Eliza Redfern.
Our domestic dairy prices have remained really quite firm here. Now, globally at the same time, we've seen that those dairy export commodity prices have been falling. So in some cases, it's actually become cheaper to import products from overseas.
It's been this vicious cycle. The dairy processors cut the dairy price in 2016, sent the industry into crisis. A lot of people left and that saw milk prices rise, and now it's the dairy processors who are suffering because there's less dairy farmers around. So it's a sad spiral for the dairy industry.
If you've been covering the dairy industry for long enough, it feels like you've seen, you know, the highs and lows, the roller coaster. So some years farmers are doing fantastically, getting great prices, and then it's only a matter of time before it hits rock bottom again.
Well, the farmers are getting good prices right now, so if they stuck around, then they're getting paid at least. But to biosecurity news now, parts of New South Wales have been under emergency orders to suppress and eliminate the spread of the deadly varroa mite. How has that effort been tracking?
Yeah, a group of researchers say Australia is in a unique position to become the first continent to eliminate varroa mite. So the pest, which weakens European honeybees, was detected, you'll remember, back last year, almost a year ago, in Newcastle. And in response to that, there were some measures put into place to contain the spread. It included things like strict lockdowns on hive movements. And also we saw millions of bees euthanised in an effort to stop them, stop the varroa mite spreading. Dr. Emily Remnant from the University of Sydney says that that strategy has worked so far.
We are, I think, cautiously optimistic that there'll be, if not a complete eradication, certainly a very effective slow of the spread. As time goes on, we'll probably have a better idea of whether this will be a successful eradication.
This week, the Victorian government handed down its budget, and I think the most nationally captured piece of news from the budget was that it'll phase out native timber logging.
Yeah, so the Victorian government says it's had little choice but to end native timber logging because of reduced supply and also recent legal challenges. This sort of had been expected to happen down the track, but the timing has sort of surprised some people. The government-owned logging company Vic Forest suspended harvesting in November last year, and that was after the Supreme Court found that it had breached environmental laws. So native timber logging will now shut down at the end of this year, and that's 6 years ahead of what the government had sort of foreshadowed it would do. The Regional Development Minister, Harriet Shing, says the government will support those that have been affected by this decision.
Whether that's skills and training, whether that's financial support and assistance, or whether that's redeployment into public land management or other growth industries.
So that was Harriet Shing, the Regional Development Minister. A forestry business director says that the government decision to phase out the native timber logging is gut-wrenching. So industry groups estimate that there are around 4,000 timber workers in the state. Daryl Hutton is forestry director with ANC, and he says sawmills will now have to make a decision whether they switch over to plantation timber.
It's not there. Like Andrews was supposed to have been planting. He said he was going to plant and do that transition from native into plantation. Well, hasn't been a tree go in the ground yet, and so it's just another broken promise.
So while the industry groups are really disappointed, it's been a different reaction from some of the environmental groups. Jess Abrams is from the Australian Conservation Foundation and says it's a huge win for the environment as the forests are home to some of the state's most endangered species.
But these forests have also been heavily degraded by logging and by bushfire. There's a huge job now to restore and regenerate these forests, to protect the carbon stores, and to make sure that all Victorians can enjoy our forests for future generations.
Finally today, Kath, some homegrown spacecraft could help Australian farmers get better access to more robust data about their land and their businesses.
The SmartSat Cooperative Research Centre is based in Adelaide and has launched a new research program that will develop Australian satellites specifically to help farmers cover more ground. This program is called the Maya Noola program, which translates to eyes here, there and everywhere. And the research program will help build tools for measuring and reporting in areas like biosecurity, soil health and crop conditions. So it's specifically focused on gathering information to help improve farming practices. SmartSat CEO Andy Koronois says it's exciting to have Australian satellites lined up, especially for Australian farmers.
It is all about developing Australian capability for Earth observation from space, which we do not currently have our own satellites and Earth observation sensors. We very much rely on foreign satellites and data for our Earth observation capabilities.
It feels pretty relevant given the debacle we had about a month ago when that satellite went out and everyone was plunged into digital darkness in the middle of their paddocks.
Yeah, and it just shows how reliant farmers are today on that kind of technology. So, really important to have an Australian product up in the sky looking down on Australian farms.
It is. And with that, Kath, thank you very much for Rural News this week.
Thanks, Clint.
Kick off your evening with a world of ideas, 6 p.m. every weeknight, right here on ABC RN. Covering everything from your health to the law, the influence of faith and religion on current affairs, to economics and the world of tech. Keep up to date with the issues and news you won't hear anywhere else. Every weeknight at 6 p.m. right here on ABC RN.
This week, for the love of birds, we'll hear how farmers and bird enthusiasts are working together to protect habitats for endangered species. We'll visit a small town that's bringing the wider world to its old people, keeping them entertained and immersing them in life beyond their aged care facility with the help of new technology. And we'll take you inside the world of competitive ploughing. It's a slower-paced sport, the vibe is friendly, but the competition is fierce.
I'm hoping to plough a good plot. Winning is not everything. It's the companionship across the board with everybody. Like when we start ploughing, we are ploughing to win. But before and after, it's good companionship and gets a little bit of rivalry. And sometimes we think there's cattle stations on it. But no, at the end of the day, it's all good.
We'll meet those competitors who are in a field of their own when it comes to the high-stakes sport of competitive ploughing. That's coming up. First today, we're meeting a couple of Tasmanian sheep producers who are going to great lengths and great expense to turn their sheep's fleece into fabric and make unique gifts for their friends and family. Larissa Smith has the story.
Three years ago, Mandy and Carl Cooper embarked on an ambitious project to turn the fleece from their flock of Cormo sheep into blankets. The couple were farming the sheep, which are a cross between a Saxon Merino and a Corridale, at Rowella in the Tamar Valley. And the COVID-19 pandemic had also cranked into gear.
There was a lot of time during COVID, and when you're on a farm and you're not getting off the farm because you're in that age bracket where you're not going to work as a pharmacist, which we're both pharmacists. We had a lot of time to think, so we went, okay, we need a project. So this was our COVID project to get this done.
What we decided to do is to get a couple of bales of Cormo fleece that we had, because we had bought some Cormo sheep from the Downies at Bothwell, and we thought we would try and process the wool into something that we could actually say was ours.
We had done the sprout course the year before, and so we had everything on paper that we wanted to do. We knew we wanted to turn this fleece into something Tasmanian, but we didn't really know how to do it. So we took that opportunity during COVID to do it.
Initially, we travelled around Tassie to try and see whether anyone would help us, and we didn't have the capacity in Tassie to do it. So we took the wool to Geelong and got it scoured, and then up to Bacchus Marsh and got it processed there for a product that we could actually take back to Tassie and produce into something that we could say was ours.
The Coopers approached Waverley Mills in Launceston. It's Australia's last remaining fully operational mill. Its CEO is Dave Giles Kay.
Waverley Mills is in a new stage of development. We're re-establishing ourselves, and it was an ideal opportunity for us to start down the path of connecting back to farmers. We jumped at it and learned a lot through the process, but ended up taking their fibre, spinning it into a beautiful boucle yarn, it's called. It gives that lovely sort of bumpy, soft touch in the blanket. We dyed it and then weaved it and finished it and turned it into these beautiful blankets. Normally a mill would process many, many tons of fibre at once, but we're able to do that in a smaller way. Still, it needs to be a good quantity, but not a huge quantity. And we can take that fibre, go through our spinning, into our weaving and the other steps relatively quickly. So we can do that within a couple of months. We would take a batch all the way through. And that's actually really important as well, because one of the real benefits for us and for the farmers is that to keep that provenance of the fibre through. And we need to make sure that we have systems that can take that batch through all the way to the end product without having any contamination with other beautiful fibre. But when you have the blanket at the end of the day, you want to know exactly where what paddocks that fibre came from. And so we set our systems up so that we can do that.
Now, processing wool doesn't come cheap, especially if you have to freight it across Bass Strait to have it cleaned.
Our wool at the time was worth $9.78 a kilogram, and that's what we could have sold it locally for. So we took on 390 kilos that we actually took to the mainland across two bales. All up, all of the processing cost us almost $16,000, so it turned out the end result, we ended up with 250 kilograms and the cost was $64 a kilo to us.
That's quite dear, isn't it?
That's massive. So instead of selling for $9.78, we ended up with a cost of $64 a kilo.
Do you think you'll make some money off these blankets?
We didn't do it to make money. We did it as a partnership with Waverley to show that it could be done and we could have a Tasmanian product. We did it so as we could give our kids and our grandchildren and people close to us something that came from these Cormo sheep, which was uniquely Tasmanian and uniquely Australian. We're fed up with seeing that nothing is being processed wholly in Australia and in Tassie especially. During our working careers, we imported a lot from China and we could see, you know, how developed that country was. But we, you know, there was the quality that Tasmania can produce is really important to us.
I mean, Waverley Mills has been here 150 years next year. It was started by a wool grower back in 1874. And all the way through, we're discovering more and more stories of wool growers who are coming to us and saying, you know, well, we did this back in the 80s or 90s or whatever, and we really want to bring that back. We want to bring it back because, you know, we're proudly Tasmanian company. We're really proud that we're here, we're unique in Australia, and Tasmania produces some of the world's best wool amongst, you know, in a country that produces the world's best wool. And it's just an amazing thing to be able to connect back to the farm without it going anywhere else. You know, it's Tasmanian wool has been produced into traceable textiles before, but it always has to go overseas somewhere to get spun or woven or whatever. But we can do all of that here in Tassie. It doesn't have to leave Tassie. So it's a unique opportunity that we have to work with the farmers here. So we're very excited about that, and it's a huge part of our future.
And you're really happy with the end product?
We're over the moon. We can't believe how lovely it is. You know, it's just absolutely wonderful. Waverley, full credit to them, they have produced an absolutely amazing product.
I think the benefits are there if we can manufacture it in our own country and employ local people and produce local product. I think that's what people are looking for.
Yeah, there's a triangle about 5 metres out that mark. So there's a triangle on the other side of that we've got to cut out and then get it all to join up here in the centre.
This is Michael Bales. He's in the middle of a competition for ploughing.
So you pull over and scrape off the dirt?
Only when it sticks.
Which is today, it looks like.
Today. Yeah.
So how long does this competition go for?
2 days.
Right. And yep. Everyone gets 3 hours?
Yeah.
That's got to be one of the world's slowest competitions, I'd say.
You have 3 hours from start to finish.
Hello, I'm Meg Powell. I'm chatting with Michael Bales and Chris Williams, a fellow competitor in this rather niche sport. The competition here is fierce, but the vibe is friendly and the pace, well, pretty slow.
We've got to do it in 3 hours.
Right.
You get 20 minutes to do the opening split, then there's a break while it's judged, and then you've got 2 hours 40 to finish the job. And in the world competitions, you lose 10 points for every minute you're over time, so it is very, very serious. Yeah.
What's at stakes in these world competitions? Do you win money or anything?
In Slovenia they won a tractor. Oh. But that is about the only time I've heard of that.
Okay.
Yeah, otherwise you just get a fantastic trophy.
Yeah. A tractor's not bad, that's not very good, in fact.
Yes. Yeah.
Have either of you ever been to World Championships?
Both of us.
Yeah.
When?
I went to Kenya in 2017.
I was in Canada in 2013 and France in 2014.
Wow, congratulations. Yeah. Did you win, either of you?
No.
Kenya
was a hard trip. Anything that could go wrong did go wrong.
Oh.
The container coming from Norway with a plough that I was going to use went missing. That turned up the morning of competition. And
with the plough still in it?
Yeah, fortunately.
Good.
Yeah, it's nice.
European contests, they get up to 10,000 people at.
Just spectators? Wow. Watching people plough a field of dirt.
Yeah, and then a field day, like likes of Agfest beside it. But yeah, it all revolves around the ploughing.
Is the soil different in every country? Do you have to do a bit of study, reading up on the soil types there and know what you're working with?
Yeah, a fair few of them do. I didn't do it. The Canadian round the first time was similar to what we're ploughing today, being black and heavy. And then the next year in France, it was just absolute beach sand.
This is Is this just free ploughing for the farmer here?
Yes. I'd say this paddock hasn't been ploughed for 60 years. This black sticky stuff is in this corner, so I get that.
And how do you know each other?
Many moons ago through Rural Youth.
And so is this a team affair, or you're just coming to heckle old mate here?
Singles.
We plough against one another, but there's a lot of coaching of each other goes on.
Yeah.
One drives, the other one change this, alter that, try and help one another. Yeah, but it all makes it for a more enjoyable day. Yeah, we're not here to try and boom and make the other one boom and small or anything like that. We're just out to have a good day's entertainment and a bit of fun.
Am I taking up your time here? Are you going to be docked minutes? Oh, no. Sorry.
My name's Colin Byrne. I'm in competition ploughing, and we are at
Lillico,
yeah, near Devonport, between Devonport and Ulverston. And we're here competition ploughing today. And what we'll do from here, who the winners and whatever from this competition, will go to Colac Victoria. And we will compete in Colac in the national, so that we can compete somewhere in the world by the winners. So it's a pretty big event, and we do this every year. It's you don't see a lot of it around anymore, because the machinery is a lot greater or larger than we normally would use on the farms today. But back 40, 50 years ago, these were the main common things on the farm.
Right. So have you been to a world championship before, Colin?
Yes, I've been to a world championship. I was went to Kenya and ploughed in the world competition. And then the next year I went to Germany and helped out.
Now, where are you from, Colin?
I'm from Westbury.
What do you farm?
I used to have a farm down at Piper's River, and we used to farm cattle and do a bit of ploughing and all that sort of stuff, and hay baling.
So you sold up, retired farmer now?
Yeah, pretty well. This is my farming at the moment, just ploughing a few paddocks, and quite enjoy it.
Can't keep a man away from his plough.
No, and machinery and playing around with it all. Yes, that's the way to do it. I don't know if I ever had time to go to work.
Now, what's this old beauty you've got here today?
What we've got here is an old tractor, about a 1970 model 165, and it's been a good old bus. Yeah, Mussey Ferguson.
Well, good luck today. Are you hoping for a win?
I'm hoping to plough a good plot. Winning is not everything. It's the companionship across the board with everybody. Like when we start ploughing, we are ploughing to win. But before and after, it's good companionship and gets a little bit of rivalry. And sometimes we think there's cattle stations on it. But no, at the end of the day, it's all good.
That was Colin Byrne, who was taking part in a competitive ploughing event in northern Tasmania, where he spoke to our reporter, Meg Powell. And before that, Larissa Smith brought us a story of sheep producers Carl and Mandy Cooper, who've turned the fleece from their animals into beautiful blankets to gift to friends and family. You can see more on both of those stories by heading to the Country Breakfast program page on the RN website. You'll find it at abc.net.au/RN. I'm Clint Jasper with you on RN this morning. Still to come, how taking stock of the bird life on their property is helping farmers improve biodiversity. And we'll hear how residents of an aged care facility in a remote regional town are getting a chance to travel the world and see the sights virtually. Pat Heaney has the story.
I like them. Yeah, I like them.
As a self-described bushy, Colin Sloth hasn't ventured far from his rural Queensland hometown of Idsvold in all his 71 years.
Oh, I haven't been anywhere.
But though age has wearied his legs, and he can't race around the paddock like he once did, he's now seeing more of the world than he ever dreamed of. New virtual reality goggles introduced to the town's small aged care facility have allowed him to travel the world from the comfort of his chair.
Where are you going, son? Far, far away. Where are you
going? Idsvold's multi-purpose health service has 4 acute care beds and 7 aged care beds, and is one of the first regional facilities in Queensland to introduce this technology. The hospital's recreational officer, Deborah O'Rourke, says the goggles have been a game changer in a town where visitors can be few and far between.
Idsvold's a small town, and it's a long way to anything, and everything else over 2 hours away. So if we wanted to go and do something, it's an hour to 2 hours travel to get them to see something different. You know, all the city people have that luxury of things at their doorstep, and Idsvold we do not. And we were really trying to think how we can bring the world to them.
Ms O'Rourke says the goggles provide residents with an escape from day-to-day life.
We needed the immersion so they felt that they were a part of something. So when you put the goggles on, you're there and then. There's nothing else. The audio is there, the visual is there, and you can't visually look at anything else. So you are full immersion into that time and moment.
Local Indigenous elder Gail Lister put on her headset to watch traditional dance at Uluru for the first time.
Yeah, I've seen them dancing. It's like you can put your hand out and touch them.
Eidsvold has one of the highest proportions of Indigenous residents in Queensland. Local Woolly Woolly woman Robin Chapman says the technology makes it easier for people to grow old close to family and country.
Just imagine yourself up in a room, having nothing, you would go silly. You know, to keep them entertained and to keep them out in the community and to keep them in their own community is a really good help for them. You know, especially health-wise, you know, because they're not worrying what their family are doing in their community when they're stranded somewhere else.
And Ms O'Rourke says she's hoping to expand the program to allow residents to relive their younger years.
So my hope is to get, I'll take my GoPro soon, hopefully, to the farms that they once lived on and worked on, and their whole life was around that particular farm, and now they're in four walls. So what I want to do is get on a horse. Oh, help me, I'm going to have to get someone to teach me how to ride with the GoPro and go for a little ride around their property. So then they can see what their property looks like now. So my main aim is to make videos of their farms and just the surrounding areas of Eidsvold.
But even if she can't learn to ride, Ms O'Rourke says the goggles have changed lives.
Bringing the world to Eidsvold is probably the best thing. To me, it's created a freedom. That's pretty well it, a freedom. And it creates the conversation and it gives them something to look forward to. And that's the start of our conversation. What do they got to get up for in the morning? They're going to get up because they're going to go to the beach today. So look up, Paul. Where do you want to go next?
Far, far away. We go.
It's a cold winter morning and the sun is struggling to break through the clouds in southern New South Wales. I'm at Marcus Richardson's farm in Tabletop just outside of Albury. On 2,200 acres, he raises beef cattle. But we're not here to talk about cattle. We're here to talk about birds. For the past 3 years, he's given birders access to the farm to conduct quarterly surveys.
So yeah, the Birds on Farm project really relies on volunteers. John Shepherd, who comes here, you know, he's a great resource, not just for us personally, but like the data they collect, you know, goes into a bigger database, a national database, which helps inform policy, and that's really important. So John's work and the other volunteers in that program, it's really valuable.
Hello, I'm Annie Brown. I'm chatting to Marcus Richardson about the volunteers who have been visiting his property, armed with binoculars, to carry out regular surveys of the bird species that live in this area. It's part of BirdLife Australia's Birds on Farms project. Over many surveys here, the volunteer birdwatchers have found that this farm hosts a huge variety of birds, including some endangered species.
They found 80 different species, and of those, there's 16 that they refer to as cap species, which are endangered or declining species. So that's a great resource that we have, that we have those birds here.
I guess as a farmer, what do you get out of this project?
It's knowing what we have here, I suppose, and perhaps valuing that a bit more. It probably gives another value to us creating shelter belts. Like we'd probably have an interest in creating shelter belts for stock welfare anyway. Probably think about their design a bit more to help encourage birds, perhaps be wider in width to give the birds better protection, encouraging a shrub layer for the smaller birds. So it provides a motivator to structure those developments. You know, they can be a second sort of benefit, not just for the stock, but also the wildlife, the bird life.
Ben Humphreys from BirdLife Australia heads the Birds on Farm project, which he says is collecting valuable data.
Birds are a fantastic indicator of the health of habitat. So we can see them, we can hear them, and we can record them, and we can get an idea of why they're doing what they're doing in a particular area. And here at Marcus's place, we've found 16 of those threatened and declining species. So this place and those birds are of particular interest to us. And we're learning a lot from Marcus and those birds and the volunteers that contribute that valuable data as to why the birds are here, what they're doing, where they're moving season by season. And we can then work with Marcus to try and create, enhance and protect the woodland habitat that they're using here. So we've found 28 threatened and declining species out of what we expect 38 species to be in this area in southeast Australia. And so Marcus is lucky enough to have nearly half of those threatened and declining species here on his property, which is fantastic.
One of the volunteers who conducts the bird surveys is John Saw, a retired academic who's been interested in bird observing since he was 12 years old.
It's putting back to my hobby, a hobby I enjoyed for many decades, 70-odd years, and it's time to put something back to your hobby that will be benefit for future generations. And that's what I see it, and I think that's what most volunteers do. And we're lucky we have a lot of volunteers in this area doing it.
How many volunteers, roughly?
I suppose to be 20 or 30 in this area doing it, and that means we do a lot of farms now. In fact, we're still looking for more volunteers because, ironically, after 10 years, farmers now asking us to do counts on their farms, whereas 10 years ago we were asking farmers to do, can we do a count on your farm? So it's changed.
Yeah, and I guess in terms of a place to come bird watching, what are farms like?
Oh, farms are unique because you've got both quite a lot in this area of natural vegetation on them, but also you've got farmed vegetation, which is different, and you can see the difference between the birds on one and on the other. And it's important to see how much natural vegetation we have. On the farm we're talking on at the moment, there's a number of areas, because we're near tabletop, number of areas which have got natural vegetation still. But some areas where it's all farmed, we want to know what's happening there in terms of birds, because farming does alter the landscape and therefore does alter the bird population.
Before I left the farm, I had to ask Marcus and John one more question. Favourite bird?
I love the babblers, grey crown babblers, which we did have a family here around the house of five. I think it grew from four to five. We were pretty excited. But the bird world can be quite vicious. We had two kookaburras turn up, and they turfed the babblers from around here. So unfortunately, our closest babblers are now at the back of the property, which is about 4 kilometres from here. So we've got to go out there and visit them, unfortunately. But.
John, favourite bird?
My favourite bird is the eastern spinebill. It's a little bird. It's the nearest we've got to a hummingbird because it hovers while it takes nectar from the grevilleas. And it's in my garden at the moment, so.
John Saw, a keen birdwatcher and a volunteer helping out with BirdLife Australia's Birds on Farms project. He spoke with reporter Annie Brown at a farm at Tabletop in southern New South Wales. You'll find more on all of those stories by heading online and checking out the RN website. Look for Country Breakfast under the Programs tab.
It was the biggest environmental rally in the country's history.
4 decades ago, the Franklin River blockade captivated and polarised the nation.
Save the Franklin!
I'm Jo Lauder. Join me to relive all the plot twists and find out why it still matters so much today.
If enough people stand up, we can win.
Dig. Saving the Franklin. Sundays at 9:30 a.m. on ABC RN or anytime on the ABC Listen app.
The Black Sea grain deal was extended for another 2 months last week. The deal between Ukraine and Russia allows grain exports to flow from seaports, and it's been critical in feeding people in Europe, North Africa and the Middle East. But much more Ukrainian grain is also flowing into its neighbours, sinking local prices and moving farmers to protest. So much so that Poland placed a ban on Ukrainian grain imports in violation of the European Commission's rules. I spoke with Hélène Duflot, a grain analyst for Strategy Grains in Paris, about this and the volume of grain moving out of Ukraine as the war drags on.
Yeah, it's really hard to know which volume of grains get out of Ukraine by the corridor, the grain corridor. because it's a mix of a new way of exports out of Ukraine by rail to neighboring countries, by sea to via Romanian ports, and also by the grain corridors. So it's hard to know how it really works by the corridor. And what we observe is that it's declining month after month due to the fact that there is some behavior of the Russia to not be very part of the grain corridor. So there is a long queue of ships to go via the corridor because of Russia behavior.
Does Russia's behavior make the ship owners nervous or make it difficult to get things like insurance to carry out the charters?
Yes, it does. There is many exporters now which are trying to find a new origins because they don't really know when ships will arrive in importing countries due to this long queue.
In every negotiation to extend the deal, Russia is a holdout. What are the kinds of things that the Russian government says it wants from the deal, or why is it always so resistant to an extension right up until the last minute each time?
Yeah, right. Each time they say that they will not be part anymore of the grand deal. This is the third time they threat this. And in fact, they are trying to negotiate to have a Russian bank back to the SWIFT system, which is no more the case since the beginning of the war. It's a part of the Western sanction against Russia. So they are trying to negotiate to be back in the SWIFT system and also to have an increase of fertilizers exports as it's an important revenue for the country.
You mentioned that Ukrainian grain is making its way out of Ukraine in a number of ways. And I gather from reading some news reports in especially the start of this year, that the amount of Ukrainian grain in neighbouring countries like Poland and Romania is causing some tensions on the ground there. Some have even gone as far as to ban Ukrainian grain imports. Can you describe a little bit about what's going on in that situation?
For Poland, Bulgaria, Hungary and Romania, but mainly for Poland, the increase of flows from Ukraine in the countries lead to a sharp decrease in local prices, especially for grains and oilseeds. For example, Poland was not able to export their own grains due to this very competitive Ukrainian grains. So stocks in the countries, in the neighboring countries, all of them, Poland, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, stocks increased sharply. And farmers were very upset because of this competition from Ukraine. So they decided to put a ban, but it was against the European laws. You can't in the EU made a ban without the authorization of the European Commission. So they allowed transit through the countries, but not the purchase of Ukrainian grains for Polish uses.
Elaine Duflot is a grain analyst for Strategy Grain in Paris. Australian labour hire companies and agribusiness owners should face 10 years in jail if they deliberately underpay workers. That's according to the policy think tank, the Grattan Institute. The calls for harsher federal penalties now come as a new global report says there are 40,000 modern slaves in Australia. Fiona Broom reports.
The Walk Free Foundation's Global Slavery Index has found Australia is among the world leaders in stopping worker abuses in global supply chains. But the foundation says there are still around 40,000 modern slaves right now in Australia, with migrant agriculture workers at high risk of exploitation. At home, a report from the Grattan Institute found migrant worker exploitation continues, including wage theft from the critical workers who get our food from the fields to the shelves. Trent Wiltshire from the Institute explains the scale of exploitation.
With agriculture, we do find that is one of the worst industries in terms of underpayment. But the numbers are a little bit rough, but we do know from previous work by the Fair Work Ombudsman and by other different surveys that the extent of underpayment in agriculture is probably, if not the worst industry, one of the worst industries, along with, say, hospitality as well. Most employers do the right thing, but we still find that underpayment and exploitation is a widespread problem, particularly with migrant workers.
Your report notes that many agribusinesses were found to be non-compliant by Fair Work in 2018, and when they were revisited 2 or 3 years later, they were still not compliant. That included more than 55% of investigations that found that workplace laws had been breached, and nearly 30% of investigations revealed wage theft. What does this suggest about how effective the Fair Work Ombudsman is? Is it doing its job?
Those figures you mentioned for agriculture were certainly concerning. We think the Fair Work Ombudsman is not doing a good enough job of enforcing workplace laws. In addition, we think the government also hasn't given the Fair Work Ombudsman enough powers to really punish employers that do the wrong thing. So it's not purely the Fair Work Ombudsman's fault. It's a combination of its lack of powers, but also not pushing hard enough and cracking down on employers that are doing the wrong thing. And that really doesn't work in terms of deterring rogue employers from doing the wrong things.
What's the solution then? What are your suggested reforms?
We think it needs more powers and more resources to do its job better. So stronger penalties, larger fines for employers that deliberately underpay their workers. We think there should be a maximum penalty of 10 years jail. We think the funding needs to be boosted significantly so the Fair Work Ombudsman can undertake more investigations, send more Fair Work inspectors out to make sure that businesses are compliant. So we're suggesting a $60 million boost to the funding of about $170 million a year. So that takes up to about $230 million a year. That's back to where it was, about where it started in 2011-12. We also think that there needs to be a review of the Fair Work Ombudsman to make sure it has the right culture and capability to enforce the law. And that includes renaming the Fair Work Ombudsman the Workplace Rights Authority to reflect its role as being an enforcer of laws rather than just a mediator.
You mentioned a change to penalties there, a maximum penalty of 10 years jail for wage theft or deliberately underpaying workers.
It's actually in line with what the Queensland and Victorian state governments have on their books in terms of wage theft laws. The Albanese government is looking at imposing criminal penalties for wage theft, and that consultation process is underway at the moment. We think that a criminal penalty is important to really, you know, have that strong deterrence for clear cases of deliberate underpayment. So we're very clear in the report. We don't want to capture businesses that underpaying on a technicality or just underpaying. We're really focusing on that really egregious behaviour. But we also think, you know, businesses should devote more resources to making sure they're complying with the law. So that criminal penalty is a real deterrent. Hopefully it's not used very often. Hopefully the deterrent effect starts to get more compliance with the law. But it needs to be there to show that, you know, breaching these laws is a serious offence. We don't take breaches of workplace law seriously enough at the moment.
The Grattan Institute also says that the working holiday visa extension requirement for regional work is a clear driver of exploitation and should be scrapped. Here's National Farmers Federation Vice President David Jahinki.
As agriculture, there is no room for people doing the wrong thing. There is absolutely unacceptable behaviour that has a slight shone on it. So whatever we can do collectively to stamp that out is really the core of why the NFF and its family are wanting to engage in this conversation. We are serious about it and we do want to stamp it out, but we need to make sure everybody's playing their part. It can't just be farmers, it can't just be workforce, and the ombudsman and the laws that are created and also have to be navigated. It's a big, big piece.
That's David Jahinki from the National Farmers Federation speaking with Fiona Broom. ABC Rural reached out to the Fair Work Ombudsman and they were told no one was available, but a spokesperson said the Ombudsman was reviewing the Grattan Institute's report and considering its recommendations. Australian honey producers have won what they hope is a final battle in a long-running trans-Tasman war over who can use the word manuka. The Intellectual Property Office of New Zealand this week handed down a decision rejecting the Manuka Honey Appellation Society's 2021 bid to trademark the word. The two countries have been locked in a legal stoush for nearly a decade, but Australian manuka makers hope they'll now be able to work with their New Zealand counterparts. Meg Powell has the story.
After more than 8 years locked in battle, a decision by the Intellectual Property Office of New Zealand may have finally put an end to what has been described as a trans-Tasman tussle of extraordinary proportions. Tensions between manuka honey producers in Australia and New Zealand began ramping up back in 2016, when Kiwi producers kicked off a legal campaign to trademark the word. Despite the fact the plant grows natively in Australia, they claimed the word was Maori in origin, arguing the plant and honey the bees make it from belong to them. However, the IPONZ ruled on Monday the Manuka Honey Appellation Society had fallen short of establishing the necessary distinctiveness and rejected the proposal. Peter Norris, Vice President of the Southern Beekeepers Association, welcomed the news.
It's a great result for Australia, and I think to appeal they have to have new evidence. But it's even more momentous when you consider that we don't export honey to New Zealand because of biosecurity reasons. But it is, Manuka honey is a game changer for the industry.
Lindsay Burke, beekeeper and board member of the Australian Manuka Honey Association, hopes this means the two countries will be able to now work together.
I mean, we would like to think that we could, but it will be difficult because of their dirty tricks. Even recently, 1 month ago, they were going around the world saying that every Manuka brand that didn't have the New Zealand marking on it was a fake. Now, that's shocking. I mean, you shouldn't condemn the same industry's product. That will get you nowhere. The consumer gets confused with those sort of things, and if they hear those sort of doubts, and people are more aware of things these days. Everybody in the world knows that MGO is the true measurement, the true ingredient that is in Manuka honey.
Now, how does this differ to, say, the situation with champagne?
Well, New Zealand isn't called Manuka, and it's not produced in Manuka. That's a district. This is a product. This is a world name for a product. We have more Manuka place names in Australia than New Zealand has.
Robin O'Brien is a honey producer based in Hobart. He says he's been keeping an eye on the debate over the years.
Overall, I wasn't overly concerned. The market is still strong for Manuka honey worldwide and even locally. And I think the bigger disappointment was that the idea that they had to protect something which I think would have been better to promote as a co-op between New Zealand and Australia, to isolate themselves like that, I just think was a waste of time and effort. The market's strong for New Zealand honey and also Australian honey and also Tasmanian honey. I think a lot of people have had their time and money wasted pursuing this problem. And I think the finding's great. Like, we don't have to do any changes on our labels. We don't have to re-identify it as tea tree, which is a common name in here in Tasmania, or any other name we could use for it. So it's a good result in the end.
I was wondering that, actually. Was there a contingency plan if they were successful? What would you have had to call your honey?
I think there would have had to have been some discussions, I think, amongst the Tasmanian beekeeping and the wider Australian beekeeping population to come to an agreed decision on a name to remarket it. We'd have to, you know, I think it wouldn't have been the end of the world, but there would have been a period of rebuilding the brand as such as that name. Because, yeah, it would have been difficult if we all went on our own ways as names we could think we could call it. It's a plant that in New Zealand we've only got the one tea tree plant or Manuka plant, the Leptospermum scolperi, but here within Tasmania, mainland Australia, we've got multiple species which produce honey. So finding a common name would have just been a priority, I believe.
Mr. O'Brien says it's highly likely New Zealand's single Manuka plant had migrated from Australia in the past.
Manuka plant originated in Australia. They believe it dispersed to New Zealand millennia ago through a weed mat or through an ocean drift of logs or something. So historically it comes from the Australian mainland.
Right.
And yeah, we have multiple species. We've got river tea tree, woolly tea tree, common tea tree, all flower, all produce honey and nectar.
You said before that you'd really like to work alongside New Zealand. It's been so many years of these legal tensions. Are you hopeful that you can, that the relationship will recover from this?
I'd like to think it would. You just got to look at the market at the moment. It's bouncing back post-COVID and the world sort of lockdown. We're seeing great demand for all our honey types, including Manuka. We come from a very remote part of the world, you know, the Pacific Ocean here. I think we could, people don't really mind if it's New Zealand or Australia, and if there's demand there, we should be, you know, pooling our resources instead of fighting over them, I think.
Australian Manuka Honey Association board member Lindsay Burke, finishing that report by Meg Powell. And New Zealand Manuka Honey Appellation Society, which was backed by $6 million from the New Zealand government, has been ordered to pay costs of $6,430 to the Australian producer group. I've personally been covering that story since 2016, so hopefully this is the end of the road. The opportunity cost of the millions of dollars of legal fees is crazy when you think of the R&D that could have been done on a product with as much potential as Manuka honey. My thanks to Kath McAllen and Tim James for bringing the show together this week. Stick around because there's nothing quite as sweet or full of potential as Saturday morning on RN.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.